And this is your call. In her new book, The Guarantee, today's guest, Natalie Foster, asks us to imagine a country where housing, healthcare, a college education, dignified work, family care, an inheritance, and an income floor are not only attainable by all, but guaranteed for everyone. She writes, under the guarantee framework, our government, the government of the wealthiest country on earth, takes responsibility for ensuring that every American's basic needs are met. Natalie Foster is the author of The Guarantee, Inside the Fight for America's Next Economy. She's president of the Economic Security Project, an organization she co-founded in 2016 that is dedicated to advancing a guaranteed income and reining in the unprecedented concentration of corporate power. The Economic Security Project just held the Guaranteed Income Now conference in Detroit, and we'll talk about that during today's show. Hi, Natalie. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. Can you tell us a bit about your background and how you came up with this guarantee framework?
Sure. I grew up a preacher's kid in Kansas and discovered organizing in college. And it turns out preacher's kids take to organizing pretty well. We're trained to bring people together or shared purpose and optimism. And actually in college, it would be Cornel West who came to campus and would say, justice is what love looks like in public. And that really resonated with me. And so I've spent my career organizing, first with technology, bringing people together at moveon.org and Sierra Club, but more recently around economic ideas, not just protesting the outcomes of policy, but helping set the policy. And so I've been heads down building alongside other guaranteed income advocates. And when I looked up, I realized it's not just guaranteed income that has made significant strides into the mainstream, but it's also the guarantee of housing, of healthcare, of debt-free college, of an inheritance. And so I wanted to write about it. And what they share is the idea that we can create a floor in America. So that's how the guarantee was born.
And what's interesting about this is I think many people get used to what is happening in this country. But then when you leave the country, you learn that nothing about this is normal, that in other countries, people do not have medical debt. They don't have college debt. I mean, of course, there's problems in every country, but the United States, in many cases, is very unique in that, you know, people struggle so much to make ends meet with multiple jobs, and the social safety net is just unraveling before our eyes. And that it always just strikes me when I meet people from other countries who are dumbfounded by the fact that people have so much college debt, or that they have to go on GoFundMe to raise money to pay their medical bills.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, there was a time in this country when things like college were considered a public good, that it would be better for society if our kids were educated. And we ourselves have walked away from that vision during really the last 50 years of economic policymaking. If you call it trickle-down economics, call it neoliberalism, you know, I think you can sum it up by three tenets: total faith in the market, zero faith in government, and people left pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. And so I think it's important to name that, because I grew up thinking, you know, this is stuff that can't happen in the United States, per what you're saying. This is stuff other countries can do, but not here in the US. But that is not true. We're seeing the beginnings of the guarantee economy be built, and we simply have to look to history to know that it's happened before. We can do it again for a multiracial 21st century.
And what you bring up is so important, because in your section about college, and we'll touch on this now and we'll elaborate later in the show, but you talk about Astra Taylor, who has written books about these issues and was very prominent during the Occupy Wall Street uprising. And she did a number or a lot of research and found that one of the reasons why we no longer have free public education in the United States is partly due to racism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. I really learned a lot from Astra, from Dr. Tressie McMillan-Cottom, who's also written on this. Yeah, that there was a period of time where college was considered a public good, and it was largely white kids who went to be doctors and ministers. And right around the time as progress on civil rights was happening and as our campuses were getting more and more integrated, is right around the time when, you know, the powers that be said, actually, let's make this a personal investment that one has to shoulder on their own. Take out hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt just to go to school. And we'll sell that as the American dream. We'll sell that as the responsible thing to do. And so I think that, you know, Heather McGee's book, The Sum of Us, which is a wonderful book, writes about how this drained pool politics, right, that because of racism, we disinvested from public goods, meaning nobody had, in her, to use her metaphor, the public swimming pool to share. And so everybody was worse off. And so it is my hope that we can build on that framework, learn from it, and have a multiracial solidarity to build the guarantee economy.
Ronald Reagan pops up in your book many, many times. And around college, you write that during his 1966 campaign to be California's governor, Ronald Reagan targeted the UC system, especially UC Berkeley, claiming that the state needed to save money. And again, as you said, this was just as campuses were getting more racially diverse, Black and brown people gained access to higher education. And so at that time, students paid $300 in annual fees to attend UC Berkeley. That is the equivalent of about $2,000 in today's dollars, so $2,000. As of this writing, when you wrote your new book, The Guarantee, in-state tuition at UC Berkeley is $15,000, with yearly student costs amounting to nearly $40,000. I think, Natalie, this history is so important. And yet again, it's just glossed over. Well, yes, colleges used to be free in California. They're not anymore. And I mean, colleges are just so expensive. And as we said in the beginning, people are in debt. And because of compound interest, they can't get out of the debt.
Yeah. Rose, can you imagine tuition that low? It's really,
I know. It's amazing. Even $2,000. I don't even know these days if a community college is $2,000 when you add in all of the books. I'm sure it's not. There's no way.
Right. That's right. And the housing and the food that it, you know, what it takes to live while going to school. And, you know, as you and I are talking, we're actually seeing some private colleges hit $100,000 this year. That is a new high watermark, completely out of reach for nearly every American family. And yet we buy into this story that tells us if we can't make that work, it's our fault, that we've done something wrong. And so one of the things I also write about is how people walk around with the shame of the debt, the shame of not being able to make it in this economy that is so stacked against them. And that's what I think is important about the new story that's emerging.
And we'll talk about the inequality because it's just getting wider. CEO pay is increasing. While yes, workers are increasing wages, but when you look at productivity, it's just not keeping up at all. And people are really struggling. I mean, I heard someone who runs a food bank say, you know, they're seeing people that used to volunteer, people who work two jobs are still going to the food bank. So let's talk about just how we got here and the U.S. infatuation with a winner-take-all system. And I also would love for you to talk more about what you uncovered about why people think government is bad. And I know that there are some people listening right now who say, you know, we don't want government having this big role. It's not government's role to, quote, take care of us. So I'd love for you to comment on that. But first, talk about this whole infatuation with a winner-take-all system. As you write, for the last few generations, there has been huge resistance to the idea of our government guaranteeing that the basic needs of Americans are met. Why? Because it flies in the face of America's recent infatuation with a winner-take-all system. And then you also write about how, you know, the market distributes wealth to those who, quote, deserve it according to its logic, and any actions on the part of government to distribute that wealth differently equates to punishing the winners and rewarding the losers. Those social objectives once achieved through public programs are better achieved by harnessing the market through private enterprise. The smaller the government, the better. And I'm sure that so many of our listeners know this line from Ronald Reagan in his 1981 inaugural address: government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. So I wonder what your thoughts are, Natalie, about how there are so many reasons to criticize government, you know, bureaucracy, for example. But then you've got so many civil servants who dedicate their lives to making sure that government works. They could leave and go to the private sector and make a lot more money, and they make a decision not to do that. So what are your thoughts about where we are right now and this whole idea that government is not the solution?
Decades of that story telling us move government out of the way. And it's true that, you know, government does need to work. I mean, you and I are having this conversation in the midst of the FAFSA debacle, which is, you know, FAFSA, how students are determined, their student aid is determined, hasn't worked. And so we have so many young people starting college in the fall, unclear what they will receive from the government. That's not okay. Government has to work for people. But here's what's also true. During that period of the Ronald Reagan, let's drown government in the bathtub era, we also saw government grow significantly for business. You know, we see the guarantees as they exist for businesses. We see the patent system, court system. We have shareholder liability protection so that people aren't held liable for any corporate wrongdoing, as shareholders. And so I'm arguing that we should extend those guarantees that really are the rules of the road for how business works to everyday people who make this economy work from the ground up. And if we do that, then we will see a flourishing of time people have to spend with their families, agency to determine, you know, how to live their own lives. And I think a surge in democracy and democratic participation if people have more time on their hands from the guarantees.
How do you turn this around? Because you've got interesting numbers in your book. Polls showed that the great majority of Americans did have faith in the government in the past. During the 50s and until 1964, nearly 80% of Americans said they could trust the federal government to do the right thing most of the time. That percentage started to drop in the mid-1960s, falling to 60% in 1968, to 50% in 1975, 30% in 79, and then by now, only 13%. So it's gone from 80% in the 50s to 13% of Americans today believe the federal government could be trusted most of the time.
Yeah, those numbers are really, really damning. I think the way that turns around is when government starts to work in people's lives, and we have a new story that our elected officials, our community leaders are telling about what the role of government is, and frankly, the purpose of the economy, right? Derek Hamilton, professor at the New School, whose economic bill of rights for the 21st century I'm really building on here, talks about the purpose of the economy to be about human flourishing, to support human flourishing. And I think that couldn't be more true in this day and age as we are marching into, you know, a future with AI and technological disruption, as there's climate chaos, right? That a wildfire can break out at any given moment in our home state of California and across the country, that there is resilience needed, and government can guarantee that floor. And when we start to see government working, I believe those numbers will go up. Let me tell a story of where we're seeing that happen. Just this year, the IRS decided to roll out a free tax filing service that the government created that competes with the for-profit tax preparation services. Now, you have a choice. You can still use H&R Block or Intuit, or you can use the IRS Direct File for free. And the government knows exactly how much you've made if you have simple taxes and can pre-populate the form, saving you hours of time and hundreds of dollars. And it rolled out in 13 states, and they're preparing to make it permanent next year across the country. That's government working and creating a guarantee of sorts. And so I want to see more of that and tell that story as we build it out.
I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of people have already filed their taxes, or maybe they got an extension and they're still doing it. Last September, Open Secrets had a piece called "Tax Prep Companies Spent Over $90 Million Lobbying Against the Free Tax Filing System That Now Faces New Scrutiny." And then ProPublica had a piece, "Inside TurboTax's 20-Year Fight to Stop Americans from Filing Their Taxes for Free." So do you think, Natalie, that this is also part of the problem? There's so much big money now influencing politicians. I mean, it's always been there, but it has reached levels that we've never seen before. And so that just muddies the waters, and it makes people so angry at the system. And so therefore, they put everybody in the same pot. And I mean, you know, both parties take this money. We know that on certain issues, Republicans take more money when it comes to big oil and the gun manufacturers and things like that. But don't you think that people overall are just so tired of the system, because you see articles like this? I mean, $90 million to try to stop people from getting this free tax filing software?
Yeah, absolutely. And that is why I'm seeing candidates running across this country, frankly, on both sides of the aisle, who are arguing that we need to have a renewed sense of antitrust and anti-monopoly action in this country, that government does have a role in creating more competitive markets. And I think people should take heart in noting that that much money was spent, and yet the minute Congress approved the IRS to do this, they had the dedicated public servants that you mentioned earlier building these tools inside of government that put users at the center, that meant when there was a rollout, it was smooth. It was almost not newsworthy because it was so smooth and it worked. And so despite the amount, despite what we're stacked up against, we can move forward when there's political will. And I think the Direct File is a great example.
Hmm. And I also think it's important to follow the money and be clear about who these companies are giving to. So according to Open Secrets, in June of last year, Republicans on the House Appropriations Committee proposed a budget rider that would bar the IRS from using federal government funds to create a government-run tax prep software unless approved by the House and the Senate's Appropriation Committees. And Elizabeth Warren and Katie Porter were the ones behind all of this. They sent letters to Intuit, H&R Block, and others, basically saying you have to provide information about your industry lobbying activities and revenue. So we have to always drill down to say, all right, who's getting this money and who's standing in the way of this?
That is exactly right. You know, every year on tax day, Elizabeth Warren takes to the floor of the Senate and makes a speech about this exact problem. And that's one of the things I think is important, is that when you file that rolls out, that did not just appear. It was not handed down from on high. You know, it was the work of years and years and years of groundwork being laid. And then when a political opportunity opens up, these ideas are seized, they're picked up, and they're moved forward. That's how progress happens. And so I think it's important, you know, to note, because it means that we have to invest in the long game of laying the groundwork to actually rebalance the economy.
Today, we are speaking with Natalie Foster about her new book, The Guarantee: Inside the Fight for America's Next Economy. She asks us to imagine a country where housing, healthcare, a college education, dignified work, family care, and an income floor are not only attainable by all, but guaranteed for everyone. If you have a question or comment for Natalie about her work, we'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts about the argument she makes that the government of the wealthiest country on earth takes responsibility for ensuring that everyone's basic needs are met? And I'm sure so many of you know that when you go to other countries, or maybe you are from another country that does not go into medical debt, does not go into college debt, knows that if they get hurt, they will be taken care of in the hospital, and the first question will not be, what insurance do you have? So we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And once again, Natalie, I just appreciate the racial element you bring to this, because I think it's so important and it is all too often missing. You write that as Reagan took office in 1981, many conservatives wanted to boost the private sector and cut back government programs. Since Americans of all stripes attached to the basic social safety net, or were attached, conservatives stoked the growing racial resentment in order to win the votes they needed for tax cuts and deregulation. So this has been going on for decades. They propagated a myth that hardworking white Christian men were under attack by a government in thrall to lazy minorities and unionized workers. And when you think about Trump, I mean, it's just gotten worse. That the ugliness of it is now out there. I mean, before it was kind of code words and things like that, but that's just no longer the case.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's what Ian Haney Lopez called dog whistle politics, that it was, you know, dog whistles aiming at a clear set of tropes that had been created in this country. And I agree with you. I fear we are reverting away from dog whistles back to just explicit racism. But it's to the bigger point, you know, race and gender have been weaponized and used against us to really keep us apart and to ensure that, you know, there's disinvestment from public goods. And I think, however, there is reason to be hopeful. You know, when I look at a state like Minnesota, there has been a long investment in a multiracial coalition across religion, across the different zip codes, rural and urban, of the state. And you now see a number of elected officials, the governor, the House, the Senate, all voting for progressive ideas in the last few years as that organizing has started to take hold. There's been $1 billion set aside for childcare. They've passed one of the most progressive child tax credits in the country in Minnesota, free school lunches. And that is a big shift from where that state was 10, 15 years ago. And so I tell that story to say, I think there is hope for the multiracial solidarity and organizing that's possible in this country today.
And you're reminding me of the important work, given that you have been a longtime activist inside and outside government, the important work of the Poor People's Campaign, because the Reverend William Barber and others, they do such an incredible job of bringing together a multiracial group of people across the country. I mean, they've got chapters in every state across the country. They are having a mass poor people's and low wage workers assembly on June 29th in Washington, D.C. It's a moral march on Washington. And we're hoping to get the Reverend William Barber to join the show before then. But what are your thoughts about groups like the Poor People's Campaign? Because they're doing such important work. And they say, if you just talk to, and they say it's poor people and low wage workers. Those are the words that they use. If you talk to them and you let them know about what can change and what policies you're implementing to improve their lives, their votes could actually change the election.
Yeah, I think that is exactly right. It's groups like the Poor People's Campaign, the Debt Collective, which we talked about, that Astra Taylor started, a union of debtors. It's the National Domestic Workers Alliance and its sister organization, Caring Across Generations, right? Who National Domestic Workers Alliance being a membership organization for domestic workers, primarily women of color, and Caring Across Generations being both the workers and the families who hire the caregivers, right? That it's all part of the same equation. Each of these organizations are just a few examples of membership organizations that are building the power needed to advocate for and win these guarantees in this country. There's no way we can do it alone. I'm often asked, you know, what should I do? What are the next steps? And I think you're pointing to it, which is join something like the Poor People's Campaign, join something like the Debt Collective.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're speaking with Natalie Foster about her new book, The Guarantee, Inside the Fight for America's Next Economy. Natalie Foster is president of the Economic Security Project, an organization she co-founded in 2016, dedicated to advancing a guaranteed income. The Economic Security Project just held the Guaranteed Income Now conference in Detroit. We'll talk about that after a break. And then we'll talk about the history she uncovers about the guaranteed income. Martin Luther King Jr. actually wrote about this in his 1967 book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will mark Juneteenth by discussing voting rights and the fight for racial justice since the murder of George Floyd in 2020. And then on Thursday, we will talk about some of the Supreme Court decisions. We will also talk about corruption and then what we're learning about Justice Alito and Justice Thomas. There's obviously a lot to talk about there. We're also going to start a new special on Project 2025. That is the conservative blueprint in case a Republican, we know it's Donald Trump, in case he goes back to the White House come January 2025. So we're going to talk about Project 2025 and what they are planning. If you have any ideas, show ideas about how you'd like us to cover the election, we'd love to hear from you. You can email yourcall@kalw.org. If you'd like to join today's conversation with Natalie Foster, we're talking about her new book, The Guarantee, Inside the Fight for America's Next Economy. You can email yourcall@kalw.org. You can also give us a call at 866-798-8255. She asks us to imagine a country where housing, healthcare, a college education, dignified work, family care, an inheritance, and an income floor are not only attainable by all, but guaranteed for everyone. Let's hear from a few callers. Let's go to Andy in Redwood City. Hi, Andy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning, Rose. Good morning, Natalie. My call has to do with your comments about Ronald Reagan and the, I think, in about 1966. There was a little imbroglio going on in the United States at that time. It's called the Vietnam War. And there were a lot of protests on the campuses. And that specifically irritated the new governor of the state. They wanted to control the students on the campuses and not having them fight the establishment over the Vietnam War. And I think that had a lot to do with the defunding of education. I don't think it had anything to do with race. It had to do with power. Suppressing the college students. The college students are usually always at the forefront of dissent and when things are unethical and immoral, because college students usually are more enlightened. And anything they could do to squelch that, to put somebody that they can't afford their education any longer, then they're actually going to have to work jobs. They don't have time to protest. They don't have time to organize. That's what the establishment wanted to stop. And they succeeded in doing that. So there wouldn't be campus unrest the way we had during the 1960s.
Well, thank you for that. We've done a lot of shows about that in the past. What are your thoughts, Natalie? Do we have Natalie?
Yes, we have Natalie. She was on mute.
Okay, go
sorry
ahead
about that. Yes, I think you're making a really great point. And I think that dominance and racial oppression have always gone hand in hand, and that there was indeed a lot of dynamics happening that allowed for a new story that was radical at the time to emerge and set a generation and two deeply in debt, you know, for the future and to make college something that we have to carry on our own backs. So I think you are articulating some of the dynamics of that period very well.
Hmm. And there's so much written about that. So thank you for the call, Andy. Let's go next to Robert in San Rafael. Hi, Robert.
Hello. Thank you for allowing me to speak. I want to commend the fact that we finally acknowledged that throughout our 2,500-year history, there's an elite few that have always used some method of divide and conquer to keep their position. That's how you rule as a minority. But one of the issues that troubles me in this conversation is to leave out the fact that the world now is more united. To have a higher standard of living in one country versus another still leads down to the same hole of a problem. Combined with what we do to the planet, as the planet is a climate controlled through balance, and every time that we imbalance one section, then we throw off the ability for the planet to survive on another, which also would then raise the question of the population. What population can we sustain while maintaining the balance of the planet to be able to exist where people are allowed to live with more equality and the ability to have the basic functions and necessities that they need? That's the overall conversation, I think.
Well, thank you for that, Robert. We're going to take one more call, and then we'll get Natalie to respond. Let's hear from Ron in Oakland. Hi, Ron.
Hi. A quick comment. I am in agreement with the author's original proposition that race has played a significant role in it, and I'll give you three cases, and I'll be off the line. One, Brown v. Board, 1954. Separate but equal is unequal. Secondly, 64-65 Civil Rights Act that made it legal, made it illegal for municipalities and local governments and any government to discriminate on basis of race, color, creed, et cetera, religious, previous, whatever. And you had a economy when those two things came out, where you had a tax rate in California and in the federal government between 90 and 93%. In fact, California at one point was 91%, and the federal government was 93%. And you also had the highest level of middle class participation in the economy that the government has ever recorded, and that was at 73%. And so when you look at the when these actions began to change the, what do you call it, the tax rate, and by the way, you can check your Google if you want to check my numbers on the tax rate. When you check your the demise of the United States as far as your tax participation of the wealthy in this country, you begin to see as their numbers go down, as the percentage of taxes that the wealthy are paying, you also notice the participation of the middle class in the economy also goes down. Mm-hmm. So, short version of a long story, but it's very true, and all you have to do is study your history and you'll see it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ron, and I'm glad you brought that up, because now we can jump to a guaranteed basic income And Natalie, in your book, you write, there is no getting around the fact that part of our resistance to the guarantee is based in racism. Black leaders have long been espousing the philosophical foundations of the guarantee and calling for the full belonging of Black people as well as Native Americans and other people of color. Our continuing challenge as a country is to overcome white resistance to true economic and democratic citizenship for all. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, we've talked a lot about the dynamics in this country and how racism has been used to support disinvestment from public goods, leaving us all more brittle. Leaving society more brittle. And, you know, things like we'll often point to the period of time, the FDR era, where government played a much more significant role in creating the middle class, as I think the caller spoke to. But it was largely for white families. You know, I'm white. My family benefited from the GI Bill, and it set my family, they were able to start a small business in Oklahoma. But by leaving out Black and brown families during that period of time, it meant that we would grow the racial wealth gap. It meant that we would be more brittle as society. You know, we live in a moment where white families have 8 times the wealth of Black families in this country. And if you drill down in certain cities like Atlanta, white families have 46 times the wealth. That Black families have. So the racial wealth gap is a great immoral fact that we have to tackle and challenge. And the guarantees, you know, are one of the ways that we start to get there.
I was just looking at some numbers from the Brookings Institute, and their latest numbers show that in 2022, for every $100 in wealth held by white households, Black households held only $15. I mean, that's just massive. And it goes back to the policies of the past that you talk about, and then the racism that's ingrained in policies or getting rid of policies.
That's right. That's right. And one of the things that I have been really inspired by is an idea that Janelle Jones, Dr. Janelle Jones, who was at the Department of Labor and now is at the Washington Center on Equitable Growth. She's an economist, and she came up with this frame she calls Black Women Best, which says that if we could center Black women in our economic policymaking, then everyone would do well. So don't just look at the median numbers of, let's say, employed workers or median wages. Look at the wages for Black women. And when those start to rise, then it will mean everyone has risen because of the fact, you know, Black women have been so vulnerable in the current economy. And I thought that was a really important notion for us that I see more policymakers starting to take seriously.
Today, we're speaking with Natalie Foster, author of the new book, The Guarantee, Inside the Fight for America's Next Economy. She's president of the Economic Security Project, an organization she co-founded in 2016, dedicated to advancing a guaranteed income and reining in the unprecedented concentration of corporate power. The project just held the Guaranteed Income Now conference in Detroit. And if you'd like to join us, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Natalie, you provide such interesting history about the guaranteed income. You write that in his 1967 book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community? Martin Luther King Jr. issued a visionary call that is often left out of our remembrances of him. He wrote, "The solution to poverty is to abolish it directly by a now widely discussed measure, the guaranteed income." In the years before he was assassinated, Dr. King was moved to speak out about economic rights after he was encouraged by the welfare rights organizers, largely Black women of that era. Among them was Johnny Tillman, one of the most influential activists of the time and executive director of the National Welfare Rights Organization, a multiracial coalition with a membership of 25,000 mothers who were relegated to jobs that didn't pay them enough money to raise their kids. And of course, that's still happening today. So it was just, I didn't know that about Dr. King. I mean, I've heard obviously so many economic speeches, but I didn't hear the guaranteed income line before.
Yeah, I think it's a really important part of history. And, you know, there would be a young Stanford student decades later who sat in the Stanford library reading that last book, making notes in the margins. And his name was Michael Tubbs. And he would take that dog-eared book to Stockton, California, where he would become one of the youngest mayors in history, the first Black mayor of Stockton. And it's then when I would meet him and my organization, Economic Security Project, would team up with him to launch one of the first demonstrations of guaranteed income in modern history. And, you know, the world would take notice. Reporters would fly in, the families, the 125 families in Stockton who received $500 a month with no strings attached. They would tell their story, you know, to the press, to the community, and we would start to see replications. 10 cities, 40 cities, 75 cities. We're now up to 150 pilots around this country in 35 states. My back of the envelope math says about 50,000 people are enrolled as a participant in one of these guaranteed income demonstrations. And we know that when people have monthly checks they can count on, that they are able to live the lives of dignity that they deserve. You know, they're less stressed. They're able to find work with higher pay or better hours at a more significant rate. And we know that things like food insecurity goes down and, you know, people are able to sock some away for savings. So all in all, it's been the current moment, I think, is really keying off Dr. King's clarion call in the late 60s.
And this is also important because, as you write in your book, over the past 50 years, this economy and this country has transformed from a manufacturing economy to a service sector economy, with the largest employer in the country is now Walmart. And if you're not in a managerial position at Walmart, you do not have regular hours or regular paychecks. You just don't know what your check is going to be. And it's still such low pay, and a lot of people have to be on public assistance as a result.
Yeah, have to be on public assistance or working another job.
Another job, right.
You know, one of the participants in the early Stockton program, his story really stuck with me. He had three jobs, and once he knew that he could count on those checks that would come in the door the first month, the second month, he was able to quit his Saturday morning gig as a mechanic and spend time with his family. And he took his kids to the swimming pool, and he sat on the side of the pool and realized the kids knew how to swim. He hadn't realized that because he'd never been able to spend a leisurely Saturday morning with his children. Mm. He was always working. And that is not what the richest nation on earth should have happened.
Can you tell us a few more stories that stand out for you? Because I feel like sometimes the stories get lost in the debate. You know, the people who come forward and say this is not sustainable, this is just not the way to move forward.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I met a woman in Jackson who the first check walked straight down to the community college and paid off the $400 that she owed in tuition, and was able to re-enroll in her classes to become a phlebotomist. A phlebotomist is, of course, a position that draws blood and is considered a very steady position in the healthcare industry and requires a certification. And that had been her dream. That was the steady stability that she wanted to be able to raise her family. And it was $400 out of reach for her. that was not possible to amass that much. And we know that 4 out of 10 Americans live like that, that $400 is not possible to pull together in an emergency. And so in Jackson, when her first check came, she was able to re-enroll and pursue her dream. And that's what we hear over and over, right? The ability to buy athletic uniforms for kids when at the start of the sports season, the ability to say yes as a parent, right? That is what those child tax credit checks meant, which I think of as a guaranteed income for families with kids, right? That went to every parent in this country. It meant the agency and dignity in saying yes to things that make life worth living.
I'm glad you brought this up because you start in your introduction looking at what happened during the pandemic when people did have assistance for rent or the child tax credit. I think the one that sticks with me, Natalie, because we covered this so extensively, is an increase in food stamp benefits. And we heard from listeners who said, before this, I was not eating healthy. I didn't feel well. I'll never forget one man who called in said, I actually could feel my calf muscles because I was eating a healthy diet. I just felt more alive. And I remember seeing a photo of a woman who was interviewed by NPR and she showed her nails. She said, before I got the increase, my nails were always brittle. But because I was able to buy healthy food, I have strong nails again. And I just, to think, Natalie, that they, the government, and I'd love for your thoughts on this, because I feel like it never really was thoroughly reported how this was taken away like that. I mean, the cruelty of that. Who actually fought to take that away and who fought to ensure that these benefits continue?
That is, I love how you are pushing us all to name names.
I think yes, that's really it's so important.
Important. I do too. You know, I think that there was a political opening. And when that happened, when there was a fear that government would do too little, not too much, but government would do too little to keep people safe, we saw lawmakers reach for ideas that were being tested and tried across this country, right? They reached for the child tax credit, which keys right back to what Mayor Tubbs was doing in Stockton, California. We saw free lunches, right? An idea that has been tested out, an increase in food stamps. And we got historically close. Let's just take the child tax credit as an example. Every Democrat except one, Joe Manchin, voted to pass the expanded child tax credit. And every Republican voted against it. We had the votes, but we were one vote shy of making that permanent. And I'll say yet, because I strongly believe that it is so clear the child tax credit is the future, is part of the future of social policy in America. And it will be the law of the land eventually. We'll get there. The reason I'm hopeful is because in the states, we've seen this energy and momentum move forward. We've doubled the number of states since that period that have their own child tax credits on the books. Just last week, Illinois became the 15th state to pass a child tax credit. So momentum is growing. The elected officials who are closest to everyday Americans, to those of us who make this economy work, they see what it means in people's lives to invest in families, right? They know that it supports local economies, that every $1 that goes out from the child tax credit is $8 in social and economic gain in their own cities and neighborhoods. And so I that is one of the things that keeps me hopeful that we'll get there.
And also, we have just a few minutes left. The reason why it's so important for these laws to be passed at the federal level is because if it is left to the states, we know that these laws will not have a chance in Republican-controlled states. That's just a fact. And that is just devastating for the families of places like Mississippi, Alabama, Texas, you name it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we don't need a piecemeal approach to economic security in this country. We need a holistic approach, which is why I think the federal government is important. But I also think, you know, the Affordable Care Act offers us a case study here when it rolls out, despite so much protest, despite dozens and dozens of attempts to repeal it, both legislatively and legally, despite Donald Trump running for president the first time around saying he would repeal the Affordable Care Act, it has endured. Mm-hmm. And we just saw the North Carolina become the 40th state in the union to expand Medicaid. Mm. And we saw in the last few years the lowest number of uninsured Americans in history because the Affordable Care Act expanded in the great crisis of COVID and was able to, you know, insure people. That was unimaginable when it passed 14 years ago. So I think that there is that offers us an example of durability when it's working in people's lives.
Exactly. And as you point out, when you look at the polling on all of the issues you write about, the people actually want these policies.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. And when people have the ability to vote on them themselves, it passes. We've seen ballot measures pass in red states and purple states that pass paid sick leave, increase minimum wage, create protections for workers. These things are popular. Mm-hmm. We just have to have the political will and the elected leaders who believe in them.
Right. Natalie Foster is author of the new book, The Guarantee, Inside the Fight for America's Next Economy. You can learn more about Natalie's work and her new book at yourcallradio.org. Natalie, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.